Welcome to the Ferris Love Podcast. Here we explore spiritual insights and practical strategies to help you cultivate a family life rooted in beautiful, self-giving love. Join us as we invite experts to share uplifting perspectives and actionable advice for navigating the joys and challenges of modern family dynamics. Welcome back to the Ferris Love Podcast. We are excited to be joined today by Dr. Mario Sacasa, licensed marriage and family therapist. Mario will be discussing how we can overcome stress as parents while also providing some insights into how we can help our children navigate these challenges as well. Mario, thank you so much for joining us today.
Mary Grace, thank you so much. I appreciate it. This is great.
So we are so excited to have you on the show to discuss this topic. And we just want to start off by kind of hearing a little bit about your story. Tell us about how you kind of came to be a licensed marriage and family therapist and what has driven you to, you know, kind of be at this point in your life.
Yeah, it's a great question. How much time do we have to talk about all of this? This could be the whole episode.
Yeah, we'll have you on again.
Sounds good. This will turn into my therapy session as I reflect on my life. Well, when I was a kid, I became a therapist really, I would say when I was in college. I started college wanting to be a doctor. That was my intention. Came in bio major. This is what I wanted to do. Thought this was the direction that the Lord was calling me to. But just wasn't jiving with the biology classes, chemistry, just wasn't feeling it. Get to organic chemistry. If you know what that class is, it's what
Skip.
It is.
Yeah.
Exactly. It is the class that is a weed out class to separate the mice from the men. And I was not part of the men, is the moral of the story. So I had this quarter life crisis at 19, trying to figure out what am I supposed to do? I thought I was going to be a doctor. Had a great conversation with my mom who said, why don't you consider psychology? And so that summer between my sophomore and junior year, I took Psych 101 and then like a fish to water. I was like, this was it. This is what I want to do. This is what I thought I wanted to do as a doctor. I thought I wanted to help people through the medical challenges, but it's not. I really wanted to help people through their emotional and relational challenges. So I got my bachelor's in psychology. My wife and I, we became missionaries right after college and after we got married. And then I got my master's in marriage and family counseling. And why marriage counseling specifically? Well, I will say at the time, this was kind of the early 2000s, this little thing called the theology of the body was becoming popular at the time. And as I was studying it and learning it, I realized, wow, this teaching that the church has related to marriage, related to sexuality is quite beautiful. It really makes a lot of sense. But it can feel at times idyllic, or it can feel at times too lofty or too unattainable. And wanted to commit myself to helping people to grow and being able to get to that ideal. And I felt that the counseling work was the way that I could help that. And so the skills that I've learned as a clinician, the theories that I incorporate into my practice have been able to help me, inform me to provide the skills, the techniques, the practices to get people moving in that direction to be able to have the best marriage that God has for them. And so I just found a beautiful harmony, I would say, between what the church teaches regarding her vision related to marriage and sexuality, and also what the science teaches about best practices for relationships. And so being able to find that and work that integrated model has been really the aim of my career. And it's what I've been able to do as a clinician, what I do as a podcaster and as a speaker as well.
Awesome. It's like it's all supposed to go together naturally, you know?
My old spiritual director would say, the truth is the truth is the truth is the truth. That's exactly what he would always say, Monsignor Crawford. The truth is the truth is the truth is the truth. And that's exactly the point that he was making. It's like if we have the right lens, if we have a well-formed conscience, if we have the right eyes that's informed by the beauty of our faith, then we don't have to be afraid of what modern science says. We can look at it with a critical lens and say, that's good, that's not good, that's right, that's not right. And we can do that sifting as a means of dialoguing with what is being communicated. And we can pull and extrapolate what is good and utilize that to our advantage. That's the Catholic way, in my opinion.
That's perfect. Yes. So as we've discussed, you know, this month is about stress and kind of overcoming anxiety and all those things. Can you just kind of give us a brief overview from your understanding of what the differences are between stress and anxiety? Because I think we hear those words quite often, and sometimes they're together, sometimes they're separated. So can you just give us a little bit of a different, a description of each one.
Yeah, absolutely. So stress is something that we all experience, and anxiety also, but let's just talk about stress, for example. Stress is, it's a response to some perceived threat or stimuli. Our bodies are really a marvel. We have an incredible ability to be able to walk into a room, and before we even thought about anything specifically, we've already determined where safety is, where threats are, where they are, where they aren't. And this ability of our nervous system to pick up on stimuli, that's the only word I can think of, that we just do that even subconsciously, right? And the way that we come to that is, well, part of that's genetics, but part of that is also our history and our memories and what we learn and how that influences our ability. So you and I can both walk into the same room, and the things that will activate your stress response are going to be differently than the things that are going to activate my stress response. Well, why do we even experience stress? Well, we experience stress because it gets us to a place where we're supposed to be prepared to handle whatever that stressful environment is. So stress is actually is a good. There's a reason why it's there. It's adaptive. It's meant to protect us. Mm-hmm. Think about when we were just hunters and gatherers. And if I'm walking out in the forage and I'm out doing my business and I see a lion, I need to have that extra adrenaline, testosterone, those cortisol. I'll need all that extra stuff inside of me to get my muscles ready to do one of two things. I need to be ready to fight that lion with as much intensity as I can, or I need to be ready to run away from that lion as fast as I possibly can. Either way, I don't want to be the lion's lunch, right? And so that's the way our bodies are designed. Mm-hmm. Now, the problem is that in our day and age, we live in a time of constant stress. We don't have much peaks and valleys. Our imaginative capacities of reflection and overthinking things gets in the way. When that gets in the way, that's what we call anxiety, where anxiety becomes this trap where we think that overthinking becomes the way to solve the stressful situation. Okay.
It's kind of confusing.
It's confusing. Yeah, it's confusing. Yeah. It's a trap. It's a trap. It's a trap. It's a trap. So the overthinking becomes the way that we think that we can solve the overthinking, right? So it just becomes this endless loop. A great movie, I think, that does a wonderful job explaining this is Inside Out 2. Have you seen that yet?
No, not yet.
No, it's wonderful. You have to watch it, okay? It's worth your time. I know Disney's had some questionable stuff as of late, but we'll give the seal of approval on that one, okay? That one's fine. But Inside Out 2 does a wonderful job really explaining how anxiety hijacks the imaginative capacities. Mm. Anxiety exists for us to try to be able to be prepared for whatever situation could be coming our way. So think of it this way. Stress is reacting to what's in front of us. And when we live in constant overstress, we have too much stimuli happening. But anxiety is kind of preparing us for future events and is coming up with ideas for how to be able to solve all those different events. So it's using our imagination. It's using our abilities to think and to come up with creative ideas. So we come up with all these different possible scenarios. But why do we do that? Because we're also trying to come up with solutions to those possible scenarios. Mm-hmm. And again, we all have that. But when it becomes problematic, when it becomes an anxiety disorder, is when that process gets hijacked and we get stuck within that system of thinking and overthinking and thinking and overthinking, and we can't get out of that. We can't break away from that. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yes. And I was just thinking of just the idea of it being like, that's your immediate good. Because that's why you can still feel anxiety even in the midst of maybe not being in the presence of something that's causing stress. So if, you know, you said stress is kind of the thing that you react to once you're in an environment, but anxiety could be that thing where you're just sitting on your couch and then you think of all these scenarios that are happening in the future and all that stuff and spiraling in your head.
That's right. Sense. And so we think about that in the context of, you get an email from your boss on a Tuesday night. He says he wants to meet on Thursday.
Yep.
Exactly. I just raised your anxiety. I'm sorry, Mary Grace. I didn't mean to do that.
No, we're good. I don't get those emails.
You don't get those emails. You're great. Your boss loves you. This is fantastic. Yeah. But why do we do that? Well, because we have this negativity bias where that email captures our attention as it should. And so we start thinking, well, what do they want? And then we list through all the potential scenarios. Did I send that email? Did I have an issue with that client? Did I do this? Did I do that? And you're already thinking through all the different scenarios that could be running. Why? Because you're trying to come up with answers or solutions to it. So your brain is trying to prepare you for whatever that threat is. It's trying to come up with answers to it. Mm-hmm. That's not the problem. The problem is that when we get stuck in ruminating about those things, and that it then takes us away from the moment and puts us in a situation where we're too fixated on this event on Thursday that we can no longer enjoy Tuesday evening.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Great clarification. Thank you.
Yeah.
Are there any misconceptions about anxiety? Because I think there's a lot of, you know, culture feeds us a lot of information, right? And so have you noticed there are things that people might assume are anxiety or assume are stress or one way or the other, and they're just kind of not quite accurate. Have you ever come across any of those things?
I'm not sure. I guess what I've been reading, and maybe you can give me some, maybe help me understand what you're perceiving as to being inaccurate. Because what I'm seeing so far is we live in a pretty anxious situation, and I think society rightfully is putting a lot of attention to it, especially when it comes to children. Somebody like Jonathan Haidt has written the book, The Anxious Generation, which I think is excellent. I want to recommend that to all the parents listening to understand who this generation is. So maybe help me understand what you're seeing.
Yeah, as I'm actually thinking about the question more, it's more so like, how are we putting ourselves into these situations to where those anxieties, especially with children, and I guess not so much misconceptions when we're seeing children more anxious or parents or families more anxious, where is that coming from? And are there more things that are more like severe in that sense of that's causing it? Or, you know, because I think sometimes we'll see just the day-to-day stressors that some people can contribute to being anxiety, but it could just be the day-to-day stress, you know?
Yep.
I'm curious what you know more about the kind of just what we're seeing today with those stressors and anxieties with children and families.
Yeah, it's a great question. So with children specifically, I'll just point right back to Jonathan Haidt's work as well as Jean Twing's work. Both of them are researchers who have done extensive work on Generation Z and what's going on there. Mm-hmm. And what we're seeing without a question is that this is the most anxious generation of any of the four or five that we've been able to kind of put some research on. And it's marked, it's noticeable. And what we can trace that to is we can see there's a line in 2012 is when the line happened, where we started seeing a dramatic rise in mental health issues with young people, anxiety, increased depression, lack of sleep. There's all of a sudden all these mental health markers just started to emerge. And so researchers look at that and they say, well, what was going on? Why, what happened there? Mm-hmm. Was it the dip of the economy in 2008? Was that contributing? This is before COVID. So what was kind of happening at that point? And what they've been able to look at is honestly, as they say, in 2012 was the first time that over 50% of America had a smartphone in their pocket. Mm-hmm. So the iPhone gets released in 2007. Google Android is soon after that, and the other companies are jumping on this. But 2012 was the line where a threshold was crossed, where over 50% of the population had a smartphone in their pocket. Mm-hmm. And we can look at that with kids now, almost 90% of teens have phones, the whole bit. And what the research is showing pretty clearly is that it is the phones in particular, in our behaviors associated with the phones that are creating this increased anxiety with children. We can see that even within ourselves. So the doom scrolling phenomenon that we can communicate, right? So for Lent, here we go. So I cast no dispersions on anybody. What did I give up for Lent? I gave up YouTube, any sort of social media not related to work. I gave up all of it. Why? Because when I'm feeling anxious or when I'm feeling stressed, it's just so easy to turn to those devices and doom scroll for 30 minutes. Doom scrolling is not leisurely. It's not a leisurely activity. It's not doing anything to actually reduce those cortisol levels. In some cases, it's actually increasing it because you go into some political rabbit hole and you start getting all anxious and stressed out about what this person's saying, what the other side isn't saying. And then you're just stuck back into that loop. So we can look at our relationship with our phones, quite honestly, as being a very clear marker as to what happened. Now, the researchers are clear to say that this is causational. There's no, correlational. There's no causational, but it's pretty darn close to say that there's a really strong correlation between the amount of hours that teens are on their phones, how they use their phones, as it leads to social isolation, et cetera, et cetera. Then schools that go from a bell-to-bell ban, how those teens react differently to schools that don't have that. I mean, there's just a lot there that's contributing, that we can say that the phone is contributing to this increase.
Right. Yeah. And that actually leads into another question that I had, just about how parents can help their children their children may be experiencing anxiety. So one of the things, yes, phones is one of them. I know that there's a documentary. I think it's, I don't remember where it's on. It's called Childhood 2.0. Mm-hmm. And it discusses mm-hmm. that yep. phone phenomenon. Yep. The Social Network as yep. well as another
the
one.
The Social Network, that's it.
Those mm-hmm. both kind of were very eye-opening, especially with that doom scrolling idea and just all of, you think you're getting a hit of dopamine because it's, mm-hmm. you know, it feels good and all that stuff. But then is there anything else that you can suggest to parents who see that their children are kind of more experiencing those anxious moments yep. That might not be phone related? I mean, it might be something yep. else related.
Yeah. So again, just ripping off Jonathan Haidt again. I don't know him, so yeah. but I'm just he's the leader in this, and he has a phrasing. He says that what's happened with parents of this generation is that we've become overprotective in the real world and underprotective in the virtual world. And that overprotectiveness in the real world is part of also what contributes to anxiety. All right. So let's go back to this. All right. Why do we experience stress? Well, we experience stress because, as I said, there's a threat that's coming to us and we need to be prepared to deal with it. The way that our bodies are best equipped to deal with it is, well, one, we can do the fight or flight. That's a piece. But even better than the fight or flight is actually getting to a place of relationship. And this is what's called the attachment system, where we have stress and we come back into a secure base. Mm-hmm. When we have security, felt security, that allows us to be more courageous, that allows us to be able to take the steps that we need to take. Mm-hmm. What's happened, unfortunately, among parents is that we've become overly protective of our kids. And so we put too much emphasis on that sense of security, but not letting them experience appropriate amount of stress in their life and knowing how to deal with it and knowing how to figure that out. So playgrounds, unsupervised play, letting the kids actually get into little disagreements, knowing how to sort those things out, letting them be on their own a little bit. All of these overprotective mechanisms that we've done to protect them, thinking that that's the thing that's going to keep them safe, has actually inadvertently created more anxiety because the kids aren't forming resilience. They aren't forming the virtues that they need. They aren't being able to actualize the skills that we're trying to instill in them. And so some of it is, it's scary, but we have to actually let go a little bit to give the X to your face. Yeah. We have to give them space to actually play and to roam and to trust that they have security. They have a secure base. Absolutely. But they actually need to face some of those stressors so that they can develop that resilience within themselves. Mm. And as a clinician, I mean, this is what we do with people when they do struggle with anxiety disorders, this kind of gradual exposure therapy, little by little, but giving them opportunities to face those fears mm-hmm. and then to realize it's not as bad as they thought it is, and then to continue to push through. That lesson that we do in a clinical setting is what we need our kids to be able to have. They need to be able to have some fear, not that we want to put the fear in them. I get it. Mm-hmm. I want to be of the safe space for them, but I want to make sure that they have as much opportunities to exercise their freedoms. Mm-hmm. Of course, with parameters, I'm not saying just throw them to the wolves, but we've become a little bit too coddling of our kids. And that absolutely is contributing to the problem.
Mm-hmm. I'd almost argue maybe because I've experienced this myself just with social media, like that almost makes you more fearful as a parent if you are on your phone as well, like not mm-hmm. just your children, but just you. And when you see all the news and it's a constant feed of all the bad things that are happening. And so that probably makes you a little more protective of your children and just not wanting them to experience those situations. I love that you mentioned, you know, the resilience piece. I think that's very profound thing to think about because I think there's just a lot of, there's a lot of fears in the world, obviously. I mean, normally.
But
giving your children that, you know, that I don't like to use the phrase safe space, but the safe space to be able to take those risks in order to feel, and you said, you know, having that attachment to be able to come back and feel safe in that regard to be able to then go back out again.
Well, that's it. If it can be that there's security, okay, mm-hmm. and there's a secure attachment that's at work, then from there, they know that, and then they have the opportunities to do some of the exploratory behaviors. We can use it. We can use that word, mm-hmm. giving them the opportunity to explore the world, knowing that they have this that they can always come back to. And so this is part of it. And I think these are lessons that we need to instill in our kids. Mm-hmm. So I'll share this. You know, we moved here to Charlotte, North Carolina, about 3 years ago, and prior to we were in Louisiana for 10 years. we asked the kids. I mean, when we moved here, we knew that it was a big ask. We knew that this was a big deal for our children. So that first year, they were kind of, you know, settling into the year. It was difficult for sure as they were making new friends, kind of the normal fare. But a year later, they caught their stride and were doing all right. Yeah. And because I'm a therapist, I like to process things with our kids. Okay. So a year later, first anniversary being here in North Carolina, we had a big family dinner. And as we sat down and we talked and just gave the kids an opportunity, I said, all right, let's talk about this past year. Let's go around and say, what was one thing that was really good? What was one thing that was really hard? And what's one thing that we're hoping for this next year? And so each of the boys, we got four kids, the four of them each took their turns. They said one good thing, which was great. They said one hard thing, and that was hard. We were all crying for sure as we were sharing the difficulties. But then we turned it to hope and had one thing about hope that we were looking forward to this next year, which was great. Yeah. Really beautiful experience that we had as a family. My youngest son, later that night as we were getting ready for prayers, you know, he really shared just how much that meant to him to be able to have that space to share that. And I said, bud, what I want you to know, and this is the lesson, is that we are together as a family, and that as a family, we can do hard things. Mm-hmm. Okay. As a family, we can do hard things. Yeah. And we've been able to survive this year. We're still together and we love each other. And that's what matters. And that as a family, we can do hard things. Mm-hmm. And so it's not that I wanted my kids to suffer that first year. It's not that I desired that for them. It's not that my heart didn't ache for them as I saw this transition, the difficulties were there. But if in the end, the lesson that they learn is that as a family, we can do hard things, then I'm okay with that lesson, because I want them to know that, so that whatever comes down the pike, whatever challenges that they're going to experience, life is going to throw hardships at them. That's what it is. But I want them to know that they have this foundation that they can stand upon that's going to help them move forward with whatever life throws at them.
Yeah. And they know that they're not alone. And they know they can talk to you about it.
And they know they can talk to me about it.
That's the most powerful thing about that story was that you know, you're teaching your children that they can talk to you, even if it's something that they could be afraid of disappointing you by saying that, oh, this didn't really work out the way that I, you know. And I think that's very beautiful and powerful for our parents to hear too, that you said you were a therapist and that's what you do. I'm like, no, I think that's just a good parent. Like, that's just good to be able to have your kids be so comfortable to say the hard things to you, and to just encouraging our parents too, that those moments are those incredibly powerful moments that will lay that foundation, like you said.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm curious what your thoughts are on, you know, you said you were experiencing with this move. It was a big move, 10 years, you were already in Louisiana. Mm-hmm. How did you handle, let's say, as a parent, your stress and anxiety in front of your kids, and how would you suggest parents who might be experiencing those things? Do they involve their kids? Do they not involve their kids? You know, like, you had a great example of having a dinner table and you guys all talked about it, but that was one moment too. But like, in the midst of the stress and the struggle and the anxiety, what would you suggest for parents? How to handle that with their children?
Yeah. Age appropriate. I mean, the move here was predicated because we were in a rather stressful situation in Louisiana. We were grateful for our 10 years that we were there. We've wanted to get back to the Carolinas, but just work-wise, there are a lot of difficulties that were emerging. Mm-hmm. And I was experiencing burnout as a therapist. There's just a lot that was happening. Mm-hmm. And I tend to be old school, where I kind of keep that aside and let the kids, you know, do what they need to do and kind of maintain my stuff between me and my wife. And and when I go to counseling, you know, those are things that I keep on my own. Mm-hmm. But what we shared with the kids was that while we were doing the move, the older kids wanted more information. Mm-hmm. And I felt that they deserved more information. And so I opened up more to them about how hard it was, the challenges that we were really experiencing. Mm-hmm. And that was really beautiful, because then they got to see a different side of me. Mm-hmm. And so even post the move, and these first 3 years, again, it depends. Like, the older kids, because I have a 20-year-old and I have a 17-year-old and a 14-year-old and a 10-year-old now. But the older two particularly, I can share a little bit more with them. Not expecting them to be friends yet, but one of the gifts of the teenage years is that you can start seeing like adulthood bubbling within them. Like, you can see it's starting, it's there. It's like behind their eyes. They're just and they're still kids, you know, like it's kind of frustrating. Like you're not quite there yet, but, but you can see it. And so encouraging that means that we can I can open up a little bit more and share with them while still not expecting them to be my friend, not expecting them to be my therapist, but just so they can have some context of what's happening, because what affects me does affect them. And we are a unit, we are a family. And so I do want them to know at least something that's happening, even if I don't share all the nitty gritty details of what's actually happening.
Right. That's good. There's a great balance there. That's beautiful. So I'm curious, so you have this course called Overcoming Anxiety, Stress and Anxiety. And in one of the, I don't know if it's a module or if it's just kind of one of the topics that you discuss, you talk about interior wounds and how those can be dangerous and self-defeating. Can you elaborate on that and just share with us a little bit about what you mean when?
Yeah, I'm happy to share about that. Well, first I'll just say thanks for bringing up the course, and if I can give a little plug for it. I partnered with my good friends at Good Catholic Media to put that course together. So if somebody is interested, then please head on over to goodcatholic.com. Use the code SACASA25. You can get 25% off that course if that's of help for you. And the way that course works is that you get an email every day for, I think we did 21 days, I think is what it was, a three-week course. You're going to get an email every day that's going to have a little description, a little write-up, and also a little video. I made that course to be as practical as possible. So every third or fourth day, we have a different meditation exercise that we walk through just to give you not only the information, but then some tools to help you navigate stress and anxiety. And you're right. One of the lessons I focused in on this wounds language and kind of shared some of my concerns with it as I'm seeing it. It's become rather popular within our Catholic language here over the last few years. And I get it. I understand why it's there, why it exists. I understand that we are hurt in life. I get that we all have experiences, that there's pain. Absolutely. But one of my contentions is I find that the language, it kind of lacks a little nuance for me. I mean, not every pain is a trauma and different. And so there are gradations in terms of what pain does and how it impacts our nervous system. And therefore it impacts the different modalities that we use. Trauma absolutely exists. There's no doubt about it. That nervous system can shut down and it can experience so much pain that it shuts down, or it can begin to disassociate, or it can begin to forget whatever that is. I understand that. I'm a therapist. But we all have hurt in life. We all have hurt in life. And as a therapist, there's a fine balance between wanting to find that hurt, identify where it's coming from, but not getting stuck there. And I think sometimes the wounds language creates this mentality where we get stuck within that pain and we begin to over-identify with it. And that's not the goal. The goal of therapy is to be able to see it, understand it, but then how does it apply to what's happening in the here and now? And what are the behaviors that I've begun to adopt in response to that are impacting me in the here and now? And so how then do I start shifting my behaviors in a different way that's going to lead me to a better end? Because the truth is that even those hurts, oftentimes, like, they're there for a reason. Okay, so example, like a kid who hears his parents arguing and runs upstairs and hides in the closet because he doesn't want to be surrounded by that. Well, that kid's doing the right thing. I mean, like, that's he's doing a protective mechanism that is actually good for him in that. He shouldn't be in that environment where he's hearing the parents scream. Now, if that kid grows up and then he develops some type of avoidant tendency in marriage where his spouse, anytime his spouse yells, he wants to get away from the room. Okay, there's the problem. The problem is that now his environment has shifted and the way that his nervous system has been wired has to be readapted to the new environment where we can coach him and help him to now be able to sit within a situation where somebody's yelling and he can be present there. If we just fixate on the wound per se, then he can be over-identifying with just being that kid locked in the closet. I want him to get out of that closet. I want him to get out of that identity and be able to see that he has agency. He has capacity. He has life before him, that God is still shaping him and molding him. And that, yes, this is part of his story. We come and we have to accept that, but let's get to a place of willingness to be able to start making some changes to what's going on now and how this story is impacting us now. And I think it's that secondary piece that gets lost so much in this wounds language, that it's just a fixation on going back, going back, going back, going back, focusing, focusing, focusing. And like I said earlier, overthinking isn't the answer. And then we can unintentionally get stuck within a rumination as I'm overthinking about that. Well, if that isn't the wound, I thought that was the thing that was supposed to unlock the reasons that my behavior has changed now. But if that isn't it, then is there another one? And is there another one? Is there another one? And it becomes this endless trap of going back over and over and over and over and over again, mm-hmm. and never actually encouraging somebody to take the steps that they need to take in the here and now, in the present, to take that information, do the processing, learn, absolutely, mm-hmm. but take that and then let's apply this to now. Let's apply this in the context of your life and let's get moving with what God has for us in today's day and age.
Oh, that's great. Thank you.
Does that make sense?
Yes, that makes total sense. Well, and I was just thinking as you were explaining that too, I'm sure that kind of how you also just address that anxiety and dress. I mean, people have roots for their anxiety, obviously.
Yes.
So
sure.
Your perspective, sure. Is that just the same mentality of like, yes, you have those, but then also you can go beyond. God has more for you.
Yes. Yes. So it's always the both and. Absolutely. Let's focus in. Let's understand where it came from. Mm-hmm. But insight alone doesn't necessitate change. Mm-hmm. We do need to process our past. Absolutely. And if there's any lingering pain that's back there, we absolutely need to process that. We need to do works of forgiveness. We need to bring some healing into those memories. 100%. Absolutely. And we'll do that for as long as we need to. But we also need to, like I said, look at the here and now and then apply it. Mm-hmm. And so there are new strategies that we can do towards them. So if that is, that insight helps them to be able to say, okay, here's that situation. Here's that trigger that's coming. Okay. How am I going to react differently to that? Mm-hmm. Now you're starting to work against the old pattern. Mm-hmm. And the way that healing tends to work is that it's a real gradual process. For example, you know, I can only speak about myself here. I used to mm-hmm. get really angry at the kids when they would do dumb things like leave cups out or situations like that. Mm-hmm. And it took me a while to realize that, hey, I'm a therapist. I can figure this out. Like, what, like, why am I getting so angry? Let me yeah. think this through a little bit. And as I did the work and understanding what was triggering, what the vulnerable emotions were, understanding mm-hmm. what's happening within my heart, I could see what the trigger situation was. Now, just seeing it didn't mean that I knew that I could react differently immediately. So I would react the same way, but then I'd work against it. And then maybe a couple of weeks later, it'd be an hour after that negative reaction that I'd recognize, oh, I made a mistake. Let me come back and apologize. Mm-hmm. Keep working at it. Maybe 2 weeks after that, it's 30 minutes afterwards. Maybe 3 months after that, it's 15 minutes afterwards. Mm-hmm. Maybe 3 months after that, it's like 5 minutes out. I blow up and then I'm like, no. And then at some point, like I'm blowing up and I'm kind of and I'm stopping myself at the same time. Mm-hmm. And then at some point I get on the other side of that and then I can see it and I can change my, mm-hmm. my behavior. And so that's the other piece with like the wounds language is sometimes there's this notion that if we just say the prayer, like it's going to be done immediately. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's the way it works. I mean, if God wants to grant a miracle, he can grant a miracle. But if we commit ourselves, as I said, to a process of developing this change, mm-hmm. of saying, okay, I'm committed to it and I'm going to be patient. I'm asking everybody to be patient with me as we're gradually taking these steps over a period of time is when you start seeing those changes actually be implemented and actually taking root.
Mm. That's a great point too. Patience.
Patience.
I think we can all use some patience.
Patience. Mercy, mercy, mm-hmm. mercy, mercy, mercy. So I've become a huge fan of the Jesus prayer mm-hmm. and I say it often. It's just simply, Lord Jesus Christ, have mercy on me, a sinner. You know, mm-hmm. like, Lord Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy on me, a sinner. Lord mm-hmm. Jesus Christ, have mercy on me. Mm-hmm. And just appealing to that mercy is so important for us as we're trying to bring the changes that we need to. Because what can happen is that we can get stuck in a sense of failure and then we lack self-compassion, we lack mercy towards ourselves. And when we do that, all we're doing is just drudging up in shame, drudging up that anxiety again, mm-hmm. and getting ourselves back into a state of being in a frenzy and we're not actually moving forward. Mm-hmm. And so mercy absolutely is the answer.
Thank you. Thank you so much for sharing all these insights. And, you know, you have your course, that one course that you just discussed, but also I know there's a lot of other excellent things that you're working on and sharing with people. If you wouldn't mind just kind of sharing with our followers what you do, in addition to, you know, that course, and then also where we can find you and support you.
Yeah. Thanks, Mary Grace. I appreciate this time. And so certainly would encourage people to listen to my podcast, Always Hope. You can access that on Apple, Spotify, your favorite podcast app, or it's on YouTube as well. I have the videos on YouTube if that's your jam. Mm-hmm. Then please check out the show. The themes that we've discussed in this episode with you are themes mm-hmm. that we discuss at length in the podcast, as well as themes related to relationships. I'm a marriage therapist, as we indicated earlier. Mm-hmm. So I have a lot of episodes related to marriage and also related specifically to dating. Mm-hmm. On my website, drmariosacasa.com, I also have a course on dating called Dating Well that's aimed at helping young adults navigate the modern dating scene. And so that's a 19-lesson course, self-directed. People can go through it as they want. And I'm really proud of the course. It's been able to help young adults regain a sense of confidence when it comes to dating. And so that's really my goal, is I want to just help people increase their capacities to love one another better, to have healthier relationships, to live a more peaceful life, to work through whatever doubt or anxiety they may be experiencing, to reclaim hope in their lives. It is possible. We have tools. We can actualize this by God's grace. And so that's my message. Yeah. And if people are on board with that, then please, we would love for you to join.
Yeah, I love that. And that's perfect to start early. You don't have to start when you're married and all that stuff. Start mm-hmm. early. I love that. So thank you.
Well, that's why I started Dating Well, actually, is because I was working with a number of couples or individuals also in my counseling practice. Mm-hmm. And I started hearing things, and the things that I was saying is I recognized there are patterns that we can establish, or healthier dynamics that we can establish earlier on, and get a healthier foundation from the get-go that you can bring that into marriage. I worked also for a seminary for a number of years, and there's an expression in seminary language that goes, as the seminarian, so the priest. And I think such is the same, that it's like, as the dating couple, so the marriage, that there's real grace, of course, at ordination, and real grace, of course, at the sacrament, at marriage. But that grace builds on nature. And so we want to make sure that you have the right dynamics in place, not to be perfect, but to have the right dynamics in place that your marriage is going to be built upon. And 100%, we can identify those. We can establish those. We know what best practices look like. There's no guesswork here. We know what the research says very clearly about it. And so I feel like it's my job as a Catholic provider to be able to offer that to people and make that information as readily accessible as possible.
Excellent. Wow. Thank you so much, Mario, for being on our show. This was a great, great interview and a great talk. So thank you.
Thanks, Mary Grace. I'm so happy to have had this time to be with you and your listeners, and many blessings to you and the good work that you're doing with this podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Ferris Love Podcast. In 2025, we are continuing to share the beautiful devotion to Mary, Mother of Ferris Love, while providing practical tools and advice for parents, couples, and families. You can help us with this mission by sharing this episode with a friend, subscribing to the podcast, or leaving a review. To learn more, visit us at ferrislovefamilyproject.org.